man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Who Shot Ya? I'm Alonzo Duraldi, sitting in as host this week. Joining me in the booth, this is so crazy and exciting, the producer of this program, Casey O'Brien, is here.
Oh, my God, producer
Hi,
Casey.
Hi, everyone. It's such an honor to be on this side of the glass
Wow. In
this booth.
It's very weird.
Way to ring out a decade.
I never look at Casey full on, so this is a
I know. This
switch.
I've never seen this side of your face.
I only speak to you people via email, so this is the longest conversation we've ever had.
Indeed. It's getting to know you, getting to know all about you. Casey, what's good?
What's good is my dog, Dolly, who we have an Instagram account for, Lazy. Dolly LA. She's a Shih Tzu. She's very lazy. She's a rescue. She does not get along with people or dogs, but we love her.
Does she get along with you?
No. Oh, she has bitten my wife Trisha and I on multiple occasions.
And me.
And
not me, but I'm just correcting your grammar. Go ahead.
Excuse me. She's bitten the both of us many times.
Wow.
And so, but we love her, and she's the light of our lives. And go follow Lazy Dolly LA on Instagram,
Oh.
please.
It is nicely specific.
Yeah.
You are ready to be the parents of teens.
Oh.
You jumped right there.
I guess that's
absolutely.
True.
The other voice you heard, of course, the lovely, the talented producer and film festival programmer, Drea Clark. Oh. Drea, what's good?
Well, thank you, Alonzo.
Mm-hmm.
What is good with me, my dear friend Carolyn Cohagen is an author, a published author. And I believe I mentioned earlier about a previous book of hers, but finally she's been writing this trilogy, The Time's Next Trilogy, and the third and final book, Time's Up, finally came out.
Oh.
And I have it in my hands. I possess all three, and they're wonderful. It is middle reader, dystopian, and the lead character, Mina Clark, the Clark, is similar to Drea Clark.
Ooh.
I inspired that. She was like, I was basically like, what's a like white bread last name? And I'm like, me, my people, we're so white bread. Anyway, the Carolyn Cohagen, Time's Up, please check it out. The whole trilogy, they're action packed. There's romance. There's a lot of female empowerment. And she truthfully did the deepest dive into theological study for it, because a lot of it's about a future where the blurring of religious extremism, Christian versus Muslim versus whatever, is actively part of the narrative, which also means the list that she must be on, because homegirl definitely ordered a burqa off Amazon, and I can't even imagine what kind of watch that puts you on.
Her Facebook pop-up ads must be
really, oh, they're crazy.
What's the page count on that?
Oh, they're in the, I'd say, mid-300s.
Okay, that's doable.
Yeah. Alonzo, what's good?
Oh.
Sorry, if I'm here,
on.
It's too exciting. I gotta jump on it.
Like Casey was even gonna give you any competition on that one.
I could have gone slower.
I'll tell you what's good with me. I know I'm late on this, but again, like, if it's not, you know, media that I'm consuming for work, I have to wait for these relatively slow moments to get to them. Ken Burns' Country Music. It's fascinating, because I'll tell you, you would think, ugh, country music is going to be a bunch of, like, stiff white guys. But, like, there is this amazing, like, narrative throughout of other voices. I mean, basically, like, black people helped invent country music, and then, of course, like, immediately got shoved out of the way once it became, like, a big thing in radio and records, you know. You have, like, Charlie Pride coming in, and befriending the incredibly racist Farron Young. You have this whole thing about women in the industry kind of like having each other's back and looking out for each other. And this hilarious montage of female singers being introduced like at the Opry or on country TV shows, where a guy's going, well, here's a pretty little lady, here's a little lady, here's a pretty little gal. You know, it's like, wow.
I just listened to Dolly Parton's America.
Oh, there you go.
And that, her whole thing with
Porter Wagner
was that exact.
Yeah,
the
Dolly stuff is fascinating. The you know, just the all the Johnny Cash stuff, his like rise and fall and rise. You know, like before Rick Rubin came in the early '90s, Johnny Cash was performing to like 200 people in Branson.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like there was a moment when people just sort of like stopped caring about Johnny Cash, and then thankfully he had this late career resurgence and really went out on a high. So anyway, just tons of tidbits and fascinating things. and like songs you'll want to Google and track down on Spotify or whatever, Ken Burns Country Music.
All right.
It's pretty awesome. This is a super special episode. It's not only the end of the year, it's the end of the decade.
What?
This is a new enough show. This is our first end of decade retrospective program. So we'll be talking about our favorite movies of 2019 and our favorite movies from the past 10 years. Also, we'll hand out our annual Who Shot You Awards, otherwise known as the Whooshies. We'll award films, filmmakers, scenes, or whatever we feel deserves to be celebrated. But first, let's get right down to it and start with our top 10 movies of the year. We each came up with our lists, and we're going to talk about them now. Drea, I know you've been dying to share yours, so why don't you kick us off?
I do. Well, we can split it up however we want. My guessing is there's some crossover, too.
Here's what we're going to do. We're going to go 10 through 2.
And I'll do them in order. These are just, it's just B block.
Okay.
There's no numbers in my world. I have an A choice, and then this is the B block.
Very well.
I remember this from last year. I just want the films to know that. All right. In the B block, you guys, Booksmart.
Nice.
Made me happy year-round. I saw so much to enjoy in it. Mm. I thought it was a great directorial debut. You know that I love the first feature that a director does. Says so much about their interest and their voice and everything, and I think Olivia Wilde did a fantastic job. Next is Parasite, because there's nothing like following Booksmart with Parasite. Such similar motion pictures. This is the Bong Joon-ho that will be on many people's top tens, maybe in here, but also across the land, and worth it. My parents only see a couple movies in the theaters each year, and this one I made them go see it at in a film festival.
Nice.
A month or two ago, because I knew they would enjoy it. And I knew it would be part of a cultural conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's just hitting. I love his work. I love what he has to say about class. Next, I have The Farewell, which was a Sundance film out of last year, directed by Lulu Wang, starring Awkwafina. It made me cry in a really specific way, which I love. I cry about a lot of things. But The Farewell had... It didn't have a lot that I personally related to in terms of the family dynamic they were going through, because it's a really specific story.
Right.
But there is something about the communicating with your elders and what you're keeping from people or how you're sharing. And then as a sort of cultural exploration, I dug it. Like, there was a lot I was able to glean from the differences of being American born versus being in China. Like, all of those things were fascinating to me. You guys, this one definitely made my top 10. Surprising or not, Hustlers, baby.
Okay.
I freaking loved Hustlers. And the more I think about it, the more I'm happy to support it. I loved the women in it. The portrayal of the female body as sexy and powerful, but in a way that I didn't feel ishy by, which a lot of films give me, of like, oh, I don't feel great for that actress, or oh, I don't love how we're only seeing her this one way. I thought there was depth to them, the complexities of how they related to each other, and the monetary element of sexuality. And okay, great. The male gaze will pay in this.
Sure.
In many ways, it will pay. next in the B block, Honey Boy, another Sundance film that really stayed with me. Mm-hmm. This is the one, obviously written by Shia LaBeouf and inspired by his life as a child actor and his very intense and interesting relationship, complex relationship with his father.
Yes.
And he plays his father in the movie.
Yes.
Another directorial debut by Alma Harrell. And I this one had a lot. It made me think a lot. It made me remember moments of Shia, who's gone through a lot of really strange public moments.
Like, and that's a movie that could have been like a therapy exercise that nobody else needed to see.
Exactly.
And it felt very like he really had something to say and something to share with people.
Yes, that's a great, that it was richer than just this like A to B of what he was going through, but was a full story. And here's this insight of this thing. And you're right, a lot of things inspired by real life. We've talked about that before, that I'm like, oh, you
just
need...
Just because it happened to you doesn't make it interesting.
Doesn't make it interesting. Yeah. And this one, I was like, no, this stuff's all pretty interesting. that one stayed with me. And I really like the tone of it.
How did that little boy have such a good American accent? He's British.
Because all the Brits do.
It's so annoying.
It's because of the TV. They watch American TV, like from the word go.
They take our jobs.
Yeah.
Okay. Dolomite is my name.
Nice.
Made my final list. I was, you know, making my list, checking it twice.
Mm-hmm.
Went through and was like, yes, indeed. Pain and Glory, which mm-hmm. we discussed.
Nice.
Stayed with me visually, stayed with me emotionally. It's the, obviously, it's the Pedro Almodovar. I really always want the consonants to be in a different way. I want them to be in alphabetical order, and they are not. I want the M or the D before the M, but yeah, it is not. One of the late entries, Little Women.
Yes.
Hey. Damn, I love this movie. It's a book that I loved and grew up with. Ingu Kang recently tweeted about how she realized that she always thought she was a Joe, but she's actually an Amy.
Oh, geez.
And I was like,
yeah.
I am a child-free Marmy, and that is all you need to know about me. And then finally, at the end of this one's my last loop, it's another female director, Sundance, from the previous year, Fast Color.
Hey!
Nice. Coming in at the end. This movie is great. Not enough people saw it.
Indeed.
It's a interesting tweak of superheroes, which we've seen so many of, which mm-hmm. I do love. But man, does it have so much to say about female relationships, about what we pass on. Oh, it's Fast Color. So good.
Get on the Julia Hart train, people. Yeah. Miss Stevens is great. Fast Color is great. She's amazing.
She was on an episode of Switchblade Sisters, which I also produce. And she's talking about the movie One False Move, which is like a very good double feature with Fast Color. So.
Oh, totally. I can see that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. All right, Casey, what do you got?
Okay, I'll go really quick because no one wants to hear me talk on this show. I'm going to do the same thing. I don't have them in order because I didn't have time for some reason. But I'm just going to go through them real quick.
You can do a block.
Okay, yeah, this is my block. So, Parasite, loved it. I always like movies with, like, forts and, like, hidden compartments and stuff. That's very, very fun. Booksmart. Yep. I thought this was just so much. This was probably my favorite movie going experience of the year. It was just so much fun. I was laughing the whole time. It was just such a great ride. Midsommar. I'm Swedish and Norwegian, so I kind of get this movie on a different level than most people, I think.
What's your home state?
I'm from Minnesota. Two Minnesotans in the booth. I wonder if my accent is going to come out. I always say I don't have an accent, but I apparently sometimes do. High Life.
Yeah.
I liked the movie High Life. I thought it was just so interesting, and Robert Pattinson is great in it. And
Juliette Binoche
and... I just thought it was such a different space movie. It was kind of gross, but it was so simple, too. I loved it. Jojo Rabbit on there. I was very affected. When I saw this movie, it really affected me. I mean, thinking about it, you can kind of pick it apart afterwards, but I really liked it.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
You're not alone.
The Irishman. What can be said that hasn't already been said about The Irishman? Really long, but it didn't feel like it to me. I liked it. Ready or Not. I really enjoyed this movie.
Twist.
I thought this was like a really fun, really like tight film. Like
yes.
The script, the acting, the directing. I mean, it's just like you're in and you're out. I just thought it was like almost like a film school course on how to make like a fun, good movie. Loved it. Greener Grass. Did anyone see this movie?
Yes,
I've heard good things.
That was my staff pick one.
This movie is not perfect, but it's so funny and interesting and doing something that I've really never seen in a movie before. The world that's created by the two directors, I just thought it was so hilarious, visually hilarious. They shot it in a community outside of Atlanta where they only ride around in golf carts. So it feels the world, you think that this world is created for this movie, but that's actually where they just shot the film, a place where there's golf carts everywhere. It was very interesting.
Peachtree City?
Yes.
I went to high school in College Park.
That's wild.
And the Peachtree City kids all had golf carts.
Wild.
First off, every street name in Atlanta is Peachtree something.
Yes, exactly.
So it does not surprise me.
Of course,
they
went full out.
Okay, and to the last one, Drea mocked this earlier, and I'm going to make her pay. Ford v Ferrari.
Yeah.
I really liked this movie.
You are ready to be a parent.
It was written by the guys who wrote The Ferryman. I thought it was a very interesting movie about how corporations take advantage of artists and just kind of throw them by the wayside when they're done with them. So I really enjoyed that movie.
It does look, it's a film that I'm like, I bet it's super well made, and I bet when I watch it, I'll totally enjoy it.
Right. No, yeah. I am meaning to get to it. I just haven't.
Oh, you haven't seen it. Oh, well.
I'm Casey. This is what I bring to the table.
That's right.
That dad energy. Hot dad energy.
All right. So my 10 is already up on the wrap, and I'll spare you the details because they're pretty much there. But a lot of overlap. My number 10, I numbered mine.
Well, thank you.
Because I'm a professional. My number 10 was High Life. My number 9 was Her Smell.
I knew that would be on you.
Elizabeth Moss just giving an incredible performance. But I think also, like, I think my favorite Alex Ross Perry movie so far, and I dig his stuff.
Cool.
But this one I think had really like the big moments and then also wonderfully quiet moments and a sense of hope that his other films don't always necessarily have, which I was really blown away by it. Number 8 was Booksmart. Number 7, a movie.
Oh, Booksmart, go team!
That was good.
Number 7, a movie I've recommended, I think, as a staff pick, Jafar Panahi's Three Faces.
Oh, cool.
You know, Panahi's still under house arrest and still making movies. So take that, Iran. Number 6.
Take that, lazy people everywhere.
Number 6, Marriage Story, which I saw for Venice. And it's a movie that stayed with me. And when, like, Dave started watching it for himself on Netflix, I had to leave the room because I knew what was coming and I wasn't ready in that moment to deal with it. And so that's how I know this is a movie that like has real power to it. Number 5, Diane. I'm so thrilled that LA Film Critics gave Best Actress to Mary Kay Place because she is fire in that movie. And the
that
film
was also a staff fire. Pick of yours.
Oh, yes. You're right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So great movie and very few people saw it. Go find it on Hulu. I think it's also on, like, you can rent it on Amazon. Just really powerful story about the kind of, you know, like, lead female character we don't see a lot in movies. There is an awkward dinner scene toward the end. That's one of my, like, favorite moments of the entire year. Check out this movie. Number 4 was Parasite. Number 3 was The Irishman. Number 2 was Pain and Glory.
I love when we have some in common.
Yes.
Ooh, now we get to say our number ones.
Yes.
So excited.
Drea.
Why, thank you. My number one is a film that was recently my staff pick, and it is a film, a French film called Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Nice.
Directed by Céline Sciamma. Mm-hmm. I adore this film. The more I think about it, the more I love it. It's one I've watched twice already. So when people talk about what they got out of, like, The Irishman or Joker even, that I did not, I get it because Portrait of a Lady on Fire fulfilled a lot of that for me.
Gotcha.
The relationships of it, how it's shot, the levels that it's working at. It's the most rewarding film I've seen recently of satisfying a viewer who's paying attention to small details, moments with hands, dialogue, all sorts of things, and how they'll kind of echo back later in it in ways that bring additional meaning or juxtapose. Ugh, it's so incredible.
That movie's opening wide on Valentine's Day. I'm going to throw out right now that we do an episode
about. Oh, okay.
I'll stop talking about it.
Okay. To quote Katie Walsh, it's a great date movie because you can lean over to your date and go, there's the portrait of the lady on fire.
And the painting is great in that movie because, like, nothing takes me out of a movie quicker than, like, a shitty fake newspaper or a bad fake painting.
Yes.
The painting is on point.
That's true. That's true.
My number one is Marriage Story.
Woo!
I was just so deeply affected by this film. I thought it was, I think it's Noah, I love Noah Baumbach.
Yeah.
And I thought it was his best movie. I thought it was masterful in the writing and the acting, and some of those scenes just really gutted me. And some people have called this a frivolous scene, but I loved when Adam Driver sang Being Alive from Company. I was just so overwhelmed when he sang.
Who is calling this frivolous? I want names.
I won't name names. I just love that scene. I'm such a sucker for a musical moment in a non-musical and musicals in general, actually. But just really just overwhelmed by that movie, and I thought it was beautiful.
Yeah, no, I love that scene too. My number one was Little Women.
Oh, yay!
I'm shocked.
Yeah, it. This is a movie that I you know, was looking forward to it. I was excited. Oh, Greta Gerwig's doing this. That'll be interesting. But part of me is thinking, really, do we need another? I mean, we've had three major studio Little Women's. There's been the like various TV versions, and yada. Like, yeah, well, okay, fine. Greta Gerwig completely like chops and channels this story, not only sort of like reshaping the narrative to make it more about like Joe as a writer remembering her life and creating this book, because Little Women has always been its own origin story. You know, the whole thing is about these are the experiences that she has, and at the end of the movie, I'm going to write them down, and it's going to be a book. And so to do that backwards, I think really kind of takes you more on sort of the writer's process and the writer's journey. But also, she goes in and gives the other three sisters the screen time that they need to develop more as characters. So, like, for once, you finally know why Amy and Laurie get together, which never makes sense in the other movies or is fleetingly glanced upon. You get moments of Meg's life that makes Meg's life mm-hmm. matter. You get backstory for Beth, so she's not just this saintly invalid. Like, all four of the sisters really come out as fascinating characters in this, because Greta Gerwig is such a great writer that she can take this classic novel that everybody's read and we've all seen the movies of it, and like really rethinks it in a way that doesn't like subvert what the book is about. It just enhances the themes. I was a wreck at the end of this movie.
Oh, yeah.
My friend William Bibbiani, who's been on the show, he and I just sort of sat in our row and like wept while everybody walked past us leaving the screening room. And it's my favorite film of 2019. So, wow. All right. So it's been a hell of a year. Thank you all for sharing all of that. We hope you enjoyed it. And you know what? Let us know what your favorite films of 2019 were. Tell us on the Twitter or on the Facebook, or drop us an email, however you want to do it. But we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about more of our favorite movies of the 2010s after we hear from another show on the Maximum Fun Network.
Dead Pilot Society brings you exclusive readings of comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Patton Oswalt.
So the vampire from the future sleeps in the dude's studio during the day and they hunt monsters at night. It's Blade meets the Odd Couple.
Adam Scott and Jane Levy.
Come on, Corey. She's too serious, too businessy. She doesn't know the hokey pokey.
Well, she'll learn what it's all about.
Busy Phillips and Dave Koechner.
Baby, this is family.
My Uncle Tell, who showed his wiener to Cinderella at Disneyland, is family. Do you want him staying with us?
He did stay with us for 3 months.
And he was a delight.
A new pilot every month, only on Dead Pilot Society for maximum fun.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duralde. With me in the studio are...
Drea Clark.
Casey O'Brien.
So it's the end of the decade, and hallelujah. We're going to look back at what we liked about the past 10 years, namely our favorite films of the 2010s. Drea, since I couldn't stop you, why don't you kick us off, and we're just going to do a top five each of the decade just passed.
Are we going to do the same thing, or do we want to mix it up more?
I don't think so, because I think this is more of a an expression of who you are as opposed to kind of a big climactic number one rating.
This is very loosey-goosey. Are you actually from Minnesota?
How about this? How about if we all do our fives and then our fours and get it done?
Oh, that's fun.
All right, let's do that. Okay. All right, so what's your
five? Some of us didn't rank them, but okay, I'll do that.
Oh, honey.
Okay, I'll rank them now.
Thank you.
So number five, I will say Wonder Woman of 2017.
Oh, nice. Fun.
I was thinking about this category of the idea of what makes the greatest film, or, you know, what are the standouts of this decade? And for me, it's that idea of did it kickstart something? Mm. Was it strong in a genre that hasn't been there before? Whatever. And in looking at them, Wonder Woman, I think, does so much for superhero films. Mm-hmm. I think it has such great attention to detail. There's some moments in it that inspire, I think, emotions that those films don't often.
No Man's Land
sequence stands out. But I've also had a lot of great conversations that just the idea of the romantic through line in that movie is enough for me, because it is based on a woman who is raised on an island separate from men. She's mm-hmm. never seen a man. And the idea idea, like, we know that Chris Pine is a ridiculously handsome, like, in all of the Western rules that we're told for what
makes
handsome.
He's empirically a beautiful
man. He's an empirically handsome man. She does not know that, and she's not attracted to him until he's proved himself to have integrity and strength and courage. Mm-hmm. And as a love story, I mean, that... swoon. That moves me more than anything. And then that's threaded through a film that's geared towards young people, towards young boys, like that there's and girls, that there's takeaway there that I think is so positive, plus some fantastic imagery, great battles, a really wonderful heroine. Wonder Woman.
Nice.
Stand out. What's your number five?
Okay, my number five. My list is, you know, I don't know if these are my really five favorite movies of the decade, but I feel like they say something about me as a person, if that makes sense.
Sure, sure.
Okay.
So my number five is Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive.
Ah.
I thought this is kind of his first...
So wait, what you want people to know is you're super cool.
I'm super cool. Just
like, you live by night.
Yes.
Yeah. You only wear leather pants.
Very pale. I think it was interesting to look at the less sexy aspects of being a vampire. Like, you're just kind of hanging out for a really long time, and you live forever, and it's like might be kind of boring to be a vampire. And
there's
so I thought
admin details.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought that was really funny and. A great film.
Cool. My number five, kind of going on what you were saying about movies that sort of revive or stand out in a genre, Mad Max Fury Road.
Ooh.
That's a movie that stays with you. I think that, you know, George Miller sort of, you know, I think realizes how fried our eyes are on CG imagery. And while I'm sure there's a lot of CG in that movie, like there's also the sense of kind of more practical effects. And so you feel the rubber hit the road literally in that movie. And, you know, holy crap. Charlize Theron's Imperator Furiosa is just like one for the ages. So that's just a movie that, again, there's at least one other one that's going to come from my top five where people might sort of dismiss it as being sort of like all about sensation or all about, you know, a specific kind of filmmaking. But if it were that easy, everyone would do it.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you.
Can't believe I lost the opportunity to give a good Minnesota amen. All right. My number four, Moonrise Kingdom, 2012.
Oh, okay.
I am someone, I like Wes Anderson. I like the very specific and twee look of his world. I really appreciate someone who's kind of made his own visual language and sticks to it. He grows it, like each one has a slightly different flavor. But for me, Moonrise Kingdom just gives me the warmest hug. I love every emotion that it brings out in me. I love the humor of it. And we're strangely tying it. Maybe I'm just like, I love a good love story. But it's also one where Moonrise Kingdom, I think, is one of my favorite romantic journeys I've ever seen. Mm. Because the through line of it, or the thesis of their little like prepubescent love story, is they're two outsiders who don't know or necessarily feel connected to the world around them or truly understood. And there is just a point where he turns to her and she's like confessed like that she's like this troubled child or the book of the troubled child. And he just looks at her and goes, I'm on your side. And that's it for me. I was like, that's the most romantic thing I've ever heard in my life. And it is. It's asexual, non-sexual, whatever it is, there's just something about it that's this pure emotion of connection. And I think that it ties in so well with the strange, like, 1950s Boy Scoutiness of it.
This is funny because my number four is Grand Budapest Hotel.
Well,
I have a, you know, when I was in film school, every person's student film either looked like a Wes Anderson movie or a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Oh, yeah.
And
so
I have kind of a love-hate relationship with him. And I think Wes Anderson doesn't get enough credit as a director of actors because I think he has a lot of really great, unique performances in his films. And I Definitely. Include that one.
All right.
And I like how he sees his actors mm-hmm. in different ways. Like, I'd say that about Bruce Willis in Moonrise.
Yes, yeah. I was going to say that, because Bruce Willis, you don't see him
Nobody directs him to act anymore.
It was like right. that. Like, he's great in Death Becomes Her, but you don't see him do that anymore.
Few and far between, yeah. So, okay, this is my one, like, super film nerdo moments of the show. So everybody get just...
Hold tight.
Movie better be at least 7 hours
long. We're going to get through it together. it is Apichatpong Virasethakun's Palme d'Or winner,
Hell
Uncle
yeah.
Boonmi, who can recall his past lives. I have to say, I was a little slow to come on Virasethakun. I'm married to a huge fan of his films. Mm. And a lot of the ones that I saw before this didn't really super grab me, like Syndromes in a Century. And I was sort of like... I respect what he's doing, but it's not hitting me on a personal level. Uncle Boonmi really got me. And like, this is a movie that is trafficking in a lot, as a lot of his films do, in a certain level of like Thai mysticism and Buddhism mm-hmm. and other ideas like that. But even without having any background in those areas, there's just something about the way this movie tells this story and the way that it captures the sweep of what multiple lives would seem like and what impact that would have and how we're all sort of in this sea of existence and there's a past disappearing behind us and a future that lies ahead of us. And it just all of that sort of great kind of like existential soul soup issues. I love this movie so much.
It's a great one, and it's something that takes advantage of being cinema. The idea of motion picture.
Yeah,
it's in how it's telling a story. It also makes you say things like, "Ooh, it's so emotionally textured." Like that's how I would describe Uncle Boonmi.
It is,
and you're like, "What a dick." So yeah, I get
trust
that.
Me on this one. Give it a shot.
Yeah, I agree. All right, number three for me. And, you know, these are sort of like big hitters. This is not a Uncle Boonmi, like, hidden gem. Mm. A few people might have seen this, but I still, Inception in 2015.
Wow, okay.
You know what? It's not the typical kind of film that I am like, yes, dude, bro, sort of element to it. But it makes me so happy because I think it's a film that as much as there is this great complicated structure to it, and I enjoy having something to sink my teeth into of puzzling out after. Like, I think film should be a spectator sport, only if spectators talk after the film, never during the film.
Yes,
of course.
Right. So this one has a lot to puzzle out in the, wait, how did this time work again? So there's a lot there, but at the end of the day, this is a movie that hinges on such interpersonal relationships, and I think that those are fascinating. I think that the Marion Cotillard and Leonardo DiCaprio pairing is incredible, and they bring out great things as performers from each other. But then there's small thing. I mean, like, even your sort of Cillian Murphy and Pete Postlewaite. Like, there are all of these different relationships that are not shoved aside because this framework is so elaborate, but enhanced because of it. And for me, that makes it such a standout. And you can watch it so many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it sets up a very complicated set of internal rules and then follows them.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a good point.
I also feel movie trailers haven't been the same since that one.
No.
Blah.
Thanks, man.
My number three film is Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, nice.
Versus the World.
Versus the World. I love movies that kind of take place in almost like a small town. It's set in Toronto, but it kind of feels like this comic. It does feel like a comic book where it's like kind of this encased world where everybody kind of knows each other. Mm. And it's just so fun, and the music's great. And yeah, Scott Pilgrim.
The best video game movies are the ones that are not based on actual video games.
Very true.
That's a great point.
No. Yeah, it is a movie that is absolutely what it wants to be, for sure. My number three is a movie that I might have mentioned on the show once or twice, Paddington 2.
Yeah!
Oh, I didn't know that you liked that.
I know. I've been kind of keeping my cards close to the vest on that one. Yeah, no, I'm sorry, haters. Paddington 2 is an exquisite gem of cinema. And again, like I said with Mad Max, if it were so easy to make a movie that were about like kindness and understanding and empathy and compassion, everyone would do it.
And it's a sequel to something
yeah.
that manages to pick up on the elements that were good in the first one, but build its own story that makes it relevant, not just a full cash grab, not
oh,
just
yeah,
whatever.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, and one of the ones that you could... I mean, I love the first Paddington also, but you could jump right to two and still know exactly where you are.
All right, my second film, or number
second
two...
Second
favorite of the decade, a little motion picture called Get Out.
Oh.
This one, I think, changed the game. I think it's so enjoyable. I could introduce this to so many different kinds of people and then have such different conversations. I found it funny. I found it scary. I found it thought-provoking. Another first-time director. Mm. Jordan Peele does incredible work here. Get Out. The great performances, a great visual, the world-building of it. Everything for this movie works for me.
Nice.
My number two is Moonlight. I knew this was going to be a difficult movie because it just felt very emotional. And those type of movies, sometimes I'm like, oh, what is going to come out of me when I watch this? And it's just, I always get a little queasy when people call filmmakers, you know, like call their movies poetic. But it is. It's got
absolutely.
Lyricism and... It's just a breathtaking film, and you just sink into it, and it's great. It should have won Best Picture,
and it
shouldn't have lost Best Picture for those few seconds. And it's just great.
Justice for Moonlight.
The universe righted itself. My number two is Richard Linklater's Boyhood.
Oh,
nice.
A movie that is impressive for strictly on a technical level. I mean, just the idea that he was able to tell such a cohesive story, even though he was getting a crew and cast together for, you know, a week or two a year for 12 years. But he is telling such a powerful story and such a universal story just about the small gradations that take place on a year-to-year level, where you are on that journey from being a child to being an adolescent to entering adulthood, and to see that not just through, you know, the great central performance, but also through the parents who are played by Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette, you know, the way that each year's shoot would have some specific kind of cultural touchstone. It kind of reminded me of how, like, when you read Armistead Maupin's Tales of the City novels, he will throw that kind of thing in just so you know exactly when you are in, like, our shared history. I just think it's an extraordinary movie. I hope that I am alive for Merrily We Roll Along.
Yes.
When's that one supposed to come out?
In 20 years.
Yeah. Well, we hope so, too.
Yes.
Thank you.
My number one is not just for the decade. It's currently my all-time favorite number one film.
Wow.
And Alonzo already mentioned it. Mad Max Fury Road.
Whoa. Wow.
I don't know if you guys know that. I love that movie so much. To me, it is perfect. To me, you are perfect. I feel like it's a Bridget Jones line.
You talking to the DVD that you hold in your hand of Mad Max
yes.
Fury Road? Okay.
Yes.
Are you like holding the signs down like Andrew
yes.
Lincoln
yes,
in Love
yes,
Actually?
Yes. It's Christmas, which is when we tell the truth. Yeah. No, Mad Max Fury Road has everything. I'm going to go full Stefan. But the idea of a huge action picture that is as thoroughly world-building as it is, that manages to build out the number of characters, the towns within the characters. Every single role in that film has a full arc. All of the brides have a theme and an arc to them. I could talk about the movie for so many hours. The idea of how that world parallels our own, but also goes into its own directions. The bombastic nature of it, the physical... the stunts and the frenetic energy, yet it's all grounded by these very believable personal relationships. Mm. I love it. I think it's a perfect film.
And it's a part four.
I know, crazy, right?
I think structurally, too, it's really, they introduce Max and then they go, and it doesn't stop the entire movie. And I think it doesn't waste any time.
No, no shilly showing.
Not at all. It's so good.
My number one is Francis Ha, another Noah Baumbach movie.
That made my top 10.
Oh, it did.
Nice.
It was, to me, the first millennial movie. and it was just, it's so truthful. I feel like, you know, Greta Gerwig co-wrote it, and I feel like it was kind of her coming out party as a filmmaker, and I just thought it touched. It came at a time where I was just so affected by it. I was working as at a restaurant, and you know, I just related so much to Francis, just having these dreams and aspirations, and just feeling like I was not where I was supposed to be. And I just love it. I think it's just such a beautiful, exciting, and happy movie.
One of the most like joyously gutting endings of any film this decade. Yeah. I love Frances Ha.
It's so good.
And my number one is Moonlight.
Oh! Yay!
You know, and you can look at that movie and sort of be like, oh, I see where you were influenced by Wong Kar-wai, or I see where you know, the other things that he might have picked up along the way. But it is so much his own show. Barry Jenkins and Terrell Alvin McCraley are telling this story with such power. The idea also somehow that a movie about a queer character of color reached such a wide audience and received such universal acclaim, I still don't know how they did it. Like, I can't even wrap my head around it. But it is, like, just every frame of that movie just has such human emotion behind it. And you know, no matter how close or dissimilar you are to this character, there's no way that you can't be swept up in his story and in his emotional growth and in just the power of how this movie portrays his life. It is a stunning piece of work.
Agreed.
That's
agreed.
Us.
So that was a decade, wasn't it? Wow.
We did it.
We'll be right back after this word from another show on the Maximum Fun Network.
Hello, Internet. I'm your husband host, Travis McElroy.
And I'm your wife host, Teresa McElroy.
And together we present Schmanners.
It's extraordinary etiquette.
For ordinary occasions.
We explain the historical significance of everyday etiquette topics, then answer your questions relating to modern life.
So join us weekly on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
No RSVP required.
Check out Schmanners.
Manners, Schmanners. Get it?
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Alonzo Duraldi. In the studio with me are
Casey O'Brien,
Drea Clark.
It's that time of year again. You've been looking forward to it, I know, all the calendar year long.
All year.
When we hand out our personal Who Shot Ya awards, the Hooshies. It's the most important award show of the year. Sorry,
many say.
Sorry, Golden Globes. Sorry, Critics' Choice.
Sorry, Nickelodeon.
Yes, that's right. Sorry, People's Choice. We make up the categories based on our own opinions and prejudices, and we're always right. So, you know, that's why we're so important. I'm going to hand out the first Hooshie Award, the Best Getting Out of Your Lane Award, to the performer who dove into a genre that we don't normally associate with them and came up a winner, and that is Charlize Theron for Long Shot.
Oh yeah.
You know,
I like that.
We just talked about like Mad Max Fury Road. Right now she's getting awards buzz for Bombshell. Yes, we know you're a powerful dramatic actress, but damn it, you're hilarious. And the scene in which her, like, she's the Secretary of State, right, in the film, where she has to negotiate a touchy international diplomatic situation while tripping balls on Molly is one of the great moments of 2019 for me.
That's a good one. To the Hooshies, you guys.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, I would like to add, because she is not here to say it, but I feel quite sure that, again, Ingu King would want to mention Amelia Clark's eyebrows in Last Christmas, because I've heard her mention it numerous times in real life. So if she got to give one of these, that's who it would go to. I have one, which is a film that introduced a concept to me, a therapeutic concept that I would love if we embraced. It's also a film that has a fashion look that I was all for until they went crazy. And that is from Midsommar. You know me, I would love to wear nothing but white linen embroidered dresses and flower crowns, but mostly what I want to get into is the award for best future therapy, which will just be me scream mimicking whatever panic attack or sort of primal scream you're doing. I'm just from now on, I just want everyone around me to get in my face and mirror back that same intense emotion. I think it's just smart. I think it's just a good way to handle emotions, you guys.
In Scandinavia, anyway.
They don't have emotions.
What am I saying? That's why that movie's fiction.
Right.
Casey?
Okay. So this award goes to Best Movie Shot on an iPhone, which would be go to High Flying Bird by Steven Soderbergh.
Oh,
nice.
Yes.
I really like this movie. It was, I think it's really interesting. I think Steven Soderbergh's a very interesting director. He talked about how he wished he could have just pushed a bunch of his movies from the 90s to Netflix when he knew they were going to bomb. I think this is like a perfect Netflix movie. It's really the script is by
Terrell Avenue McCready. Yeah.
And it's just really tight, and it shows you that, you know, to be a filmmaker, you don't need that much. And while watching it, it's a very engaging and interesting film. And if you're a basketball fan, it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. Orson Welles once famously said that to be a poet, you need a pen, and to be a filmmaker, you need an army. But you don't anymore. Yeah. I love that movie. And certainly of the two Steven Soderbergh films that came out this year, it is the much, much better one.
Wait, what was the other one?
The Laundromat.
Oh, I didn't see that one.
Just don't.
There's also a really funny picture of Steven Soderbergh shooting the movie, because he's also the cinematographer on High Flying Bird, and he just literally has an iPhone on a... it's very strange to see.
Because I know he works with enormous crews, all these people, all centered behind a dude with a phone twisted sideways. All right.
What do you got?
Okay, so I have an award for Best Food in Movies.
Oh, that's great.
These are my nominees. The PB&J sandwich in Avengers Endgame.
Oh, okay.
You might remember that. I'm getting real specific. Scarlett Johansson is making it and then is interrupted.
Yes.
Shout out to that PB&J. Keanu Reeves food that play with time, the concept of time, in Always Be My Maybe.
Yes.
Do you have any food that plays with time, the concept of time?
Where is the awards campaign for him this year for that movie? Come on. For shame.
And finally, it's a trifecta from The Irishman, the beer-steamed hot dogs, the ice cream sand sundaes, and the big-ass steak.
Oh, hell yeah.
This is a very food movie.
Now the stolen from a truck steak or the testimonial dinner steak?
The stolen from... I want the hot steak.
You're right.
In both senses of the meaning.
Indeed. Yes, absolutely. You got one more for you?
I have one more. This goes to my favorite pair of documentaries about the exact same thing. The Fire Festival, they came out this year.
That was this year.
Yeah. Okay, so
that's how long 2019 was.
The two documentaries that were about the exact same thing, the Fire Festival documentaries. I don't remember the names of each individual documentary, but there could have been 19 of these documentaries. I loved watching them. It was so insane.
They were delicious. I'm going to close out with an award that is both an award to people who did a great thing and a tiny bit of shade to someone else, but you be the judge on that one. The best movie about Charles Manson of 2019 is Charlie Says.
It was Mary Harron's.
Yes,
yes, indeed it is.
Written by Guinevere Turner about the women in the Manson cult who on death row basically had to be deprogrammed to figure out what it was that they had perpetrated, and the woman responsible for helping them through that process, who both wanted to rescue them from the mental hold that Manson had on them, also knowing, however, that they were going to suddenly now feel the deep shame and responsibility of the horrible events that transpired. It's a great movie.
Played by Merritt Weaver.
Yes.
It's so good. Please go watch
it. It is so good. Do check it out. So those are the Hooshies. We stand by them, and everyone else is wrong.
Congratulations to all the winners.
Yes.
You're here.
Come collect them at the office. We'll shake your hand. now it's time for staff picks. It can be any movie in theaters, streaming, what have you. Drea, kick us off.
Mine is a movie that's gotten a couple references already this evening, but it's still worth it. Little Women.
Mm.
Little Women opens on Christmas Day.
Yes.
It's wonderful for the whole family. Little Women.
This episode is coming out right before New Year's Eve, so I'm going to give a New Year's Eve recommendation.
Okay.
200 Cigarettes.
This isn't
technically a good movie, but it's a fun movie, and I love the structure, and I love what it's going for. 1980 New York. I don't know. It's just a blast. It's a fun movie to watch, to be like, oh, look at all these.
The casting
is insane.
It's a cast of like 83 people.
Yeah, and they're all really famous now.
Famous ass people.
Yeah. Ben Affleck, Paul Rudd, Courtney Love, Dave Chappelle,
Plimpton,
Martha Plimpton,
Christina Ricci,
Kate Hudson, just a million people. I don't think that director has done anything since.
She started as a casting agent.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Also, it's very disturbing to me that that movie came out in 1999 and it's about 1980, which was 19 years prior, and that was now 20. The year it came out is 20 years prior to now. So,
wow,
disturbing.
You know, this is just a complete rando out of my hat choice, but it's a movie that I like, and I always like pushing on people. And because, you know, with the holidays ending and now it's just winter, which kind of sucks, I thought, well, what's a fun, summery, kind of, you know, just splashy, sun-dappled movie? And I'm going to recommend Back to the Beach, the 1987 comedy that brought back Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello.
Oh, snap!
It is decidedly wacky and,
yes,
and self-consciously ridiculous, and tons of fun and great cameos from everybody from Connie Stevens to Pee Wee Herman, and it co-stars disgraced Hallmark star Lori Loughlin. What's not to like? So, all right. Anyway, thank you all for listening. Just a reminder real quick, you can buy a Jumbotron for this program. It's a fun way to show your support for all your favorite Max Fun shows and get the word out about what you're up to. It's easy and cheap. Only $100 for a personal message or $200 for a promotional one. So if you want us to give a special shout out to a friend or loved one, or perhaps promote your burgeoning business, check us out at MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at WhoShotYaPod. Our Facebook group can be found at Facebook.com/groups/WhoShotYaPodcast, or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Our producer and co-host this week is Casey O'Brien. Get out and never come back to this room.
No, you did so good.
No, this was a hoot. We have to do it again. And our senior producer is Laura Swisher. It's the end of the year, so it's that time to look back on ourselves the past year, maybe try and make things better in the coming year. My New Year's resolution is to maybe try and stop playing so many damn games on my phone so that my carpal tunnel is not constantly aggravated.
My New Year's resolution is to drink 10 glasses of water a day.
Ew.
My New Year's resolution is to keep all the plants alive in my apartment.
Oh, wow. You're a better man than I. Good luck with that. Wishing all of you guys a very happy new year. Thank you for getting through this last 12 months with us. And we're very excited about what the next 12 will bring. So we'll catch you then. Until next time, this has been a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.